Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Initech.
No, you're working at Initech because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world, and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Oh, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
If I had $1 million.
We have Andrew on the board. S&P futures are up 575. NASDAQ futures up 26. We've got NVIDIA earnings tonight. We'll see how those go. They're going to see.
You know, but really, as you look back, is there really a time in history that wasn't interesting?
50s were pretty boring. Actually,
a lot of people say that, but David Halberstam wrote a book called The 50s. And it sort of covered everything from cultural stuff to music, the evolution of rock and roll coming out in the 50s, the quiz show stuff, all of that scandal, but also television getting front and center and who were the stars and, you know, the people who really made the industry. Development of are we going to do the hydrogen bomb or not? Everything going on with the Korean War. I mean, I could go on with that. The 50s were not all that dull in hindsight.
Well, we're talking relative term. I mean, the Clinton era was very dull. He didn't have any real big crises to deal with, other than himself.
No, but not too long after that, they did.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of the makings were in there. So if you were to go back and write the history, for instance, you know, we would have the 9/11 attacks in 2001, but now if you were to explore the history, the seeds of that were well into the Clinton era, and the things that were going on. And this is not, you know, that's not necessarily to blame, although there may be some blame in there as well. But we, you know, we had the first attempt at the Trade Center was part of that.
Yeah.
You did have the boom of the dot bomb era before it bombed. there was a lot going on there too. I think as we look back, and then you can, you know, you get into the culture stuff, this, you know, sports, you know, and anything that's part of that. How many great movies were made in that era, and how many important movies were made?
Well, how many songs were written? I mean, virtually every. But I guess I don't know that we've ever been under this kind of economic pressure. I mean, it's been coming for a long time. We've never seen this kind of, in terms of, you know, people fighting back and forth.
Not since the latter half of the 70s, for sure.
No, this, what I'm trying to get to here is the differentiation of the nobles and the serfs, which is really all you can describe this as, where a few people have all the dough. You know, not all, but damn near all. And I, you know, this is not the 70s. This is not the 80s. This is not. I mean, the fact that a real lot of people are never going to be able to have things that their parents took for granted.
Yeah, I do agree with that. I think the transfer of wealth from the middle class to the upper class has been tremendous. Tremendous. Not tremendous great, but tremendous in terms of degree. And that's something that is specific to this era, I think. But, and again, go back and look at politics. You know, we think politics is crazy now. We had a Gerald Ford as president because Nixon had to resign. We had Gerald Ford as vice president because Spiro Agnew had to resign as part of his no contest plea to corruption when he was the governor of Maryland. And how many of the people in the Nixon administration actually served jail time? You know, I think it was like 10 or 11 or something like that.
But for different reasons.
Right, but still it was political craziness. And, you know, in some ways they made today's political nonsense look like, you know, politicians look like a bunch of hikers when it comes to craziness.
Well, at least they have fights with the idea that people are all over this money. I don't think the senators in Nixon's era were all millionaires. Or not all of them, the ones that were, the money flying around Washington. There's always been money there. Don't get me wrong. I mean, obviously the military-industrial establishment that Eisenhower talked about. I mean, clearly it was there. But you didn't have a president.
Yeah, I would take the seeds of today and the politicians accumulating wealth. I would take that back into the 80s and well through the 90s as the seeds of it. And now it's just, you know. You look at the wealth that people have that they didn't have before they took office. But, you know, Biden would be a good example of a guy who was, how long was he around? 40 plus years. So you know, go back to there, and that was when he started accumulating wealth as a senator.
Well, you have nowhere back in those days did you have an individual salary rate, median income of 40 grand, and a fat drug, you know, people take it, I mean, obviously you need it, a fat drug that costs $1,000, it costs the place 5 hours to make. That wasn't around in the 70s. Under any stretch, was this amazing overcharging of people because of patent laws and because of stuff in people's pockets. This is a whole new world.
I'd have to think about that as to how new it really is.
I'm not yesterday.
I'm not arguing with you. I'm saying I don't know. I'd have to think about that one.
Viagra was 19 years. It cost $5 to make, and they charge 50. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been, but I don't think that was that. Of course, you didn't have Viagra in the 70s, but I don't think the shot of penicillin was like $100.
God, what if we had Viagra in the 70s?
Oh, God. people didn't live as long. If you're dead, you don't worry about it, right?
But I guess not.
But this is, we've got these, but it seems like it's freezing people in the sense that we can't do anything about the medical stuff because everybody's, their ass has been stuffed with cash from these people. We just can't do it. You know, and I wonder. I mean, obviously, and we have a war going on, where one of the presidents in the last 8 years has grabbed money from one side, and you wonder what his motivations are. And the other guy who's coming in now has had nothing but business dealings with the Russians, and you wonder. I don't want anybody with any of that, Kevin. I really don't. I'm not accusing anybody of anything. It's just untoward. It's just not. I don't trust anybody who's been involved in stuff like that to make the right calls. I just don't.
Yeah, if you take Trump out of the equation, and just say you would love some outsider successful business person to come in. They're and if they've done any international dealings, then they probably have done business with the Chinese and with the Russians. They should have extreme scrutiny about the process, about what they did and what they went through, and who are you beholden to anybody in particular? And I agree with that, but I don't know if you want the outsider, then you're going to get a certain amount of that, and there's just not much you can do.
Sure. I mean, we had big international interests was Herbert Hoover. He was a brilliant engineer and had projects all over the world, but I don't think. Anybody, you know, one area saved his ass by buying condos in a place he couldn't sell to somebody else. I mean, you wonder what the entrails are of that. Maybe they're none, which is fine. You know, we got to talk two things. I'm gonna, if I can find the other one, a little bit about Yaz. I got this thing from Quora where somebody said, is he overrated, underrated? And the answer was both. And then he went through his whole explanation. It's pretty interesting. But anyway, Bob Love. One of my guys on the Bulls when I really followed this basketball and actually was crazy enough to love pro sports. He was one of my guys. It was him and Chet Walker and Tom Barwinkle and Jerry Sloan, Norm Van Leer. That was my team. And Butterbean died the other day at age of 81 from cancer. But his life story is more than just a basketball player, Kevin. I don't know if you dug into much of it, or if you know a lot about it.
Yeah, I'm really aware of it. He was the son of a sharecropper growing up, and in Louisiana, did a lot of work in the fields, played high school football and basketball, and got I think it was Southern University is where he went to Southern University. He actually went on a football scholarship. But wound up playing basketball there. Got drafted. I think Cincinnati didn't make the team. Got cut, went and played in the Eastern Basketball League. Was the MVP of the league, came back, made the roster the next year in Cincinnati. Knocked around there a couple of years, played for the Bucks, took him in the expansion draft, traded him to the Bulls partway through the season, and he had a very long, successful career with the Bulls, where he averaged about 21 points a game for the whole career. And the only time he was really below 21 was the year his last full season with him, when he merely averaged 19.1 points per game.
Well, the story, we talk about somebody growing up a little different. His father was what? Amazingly abusive. So he left home at age 8 and traveled to his grandmother's place. And he had a horrendous stutter. So nobody would hire him, and nobody even wanted him to play basketball for him. He almost couldn't get into high school or college because he stuttered so bad. And he did on the Bulls. And he ended up
going, and Dick Motta embraced him, and his teammates embraced him. He had, you know, a really good set of teammates with him there, and so he was able to thrive with the Bulls despite the stuttering. But keep going, because the story gets more.
But then he ended up, when he left basketball, he worked in a restaurant, in a chopping up, you know, whatever restaurant people do. And he ended up as a dishwasher, because he couldn't talk. And he ended up
he worked for Nordstrom's and their, you know, their restaurant, sort of like Marshall Field's used to have a restaurant. Nordstrom's had a restaurant in Seattle, and that was where he worked. And John Nordstrom actually is the guy who said you should get speech therapy, and started him through it.
And he ended up being a motivational speaker and all kinds of stuff. And you know, just really, it's a human interest story in one sense. On the other hand, it's a pretty horrible way to grow up, for God's sake.
Because if you stutter, you go to school, kids are going to be brutal.
I'll bet.
So you just don't talk. You know, you just don't say anything. You live sort of in a private world.
Well, doesn't Biden have some issues with that, or didn't he, or something? It's been a problem.
He grew up as a stutterer, yeah.
And anyway, it's kind of interesting. So we don't spend too much time on this, Kevin, but I was reading this, and as you know, our buddies from Boston at Notre Dame always were huge Yaz guys. And the thing that I remember about Yaz is that didn't the storied Notre Dame coach say he'd never be a ball player or something like that? when he tried to play for Notre Dame, wasn't that the drill?
I think Jake Klein kind of, poo-pooed him for sure. I don't remember the full story, but... not the finest moment.
No.
not Jake Klein's finest moment as a Notre Dame, longtime Notre Dame baseball coach.
No, but he has a field named after him. He's got that going for him.
Yeah, well, what more do you need, huh?
But it's interesting. See, he broke into the Reds. Normally when somebody says, was he overrated or underrated, you wouldn't say both. Because his... I'll just be brief on this, but he, when he first came into the league, he had like 6 years where he was somewhat, you know, he was a good ball player, all star a couple times, but evidently he had 3 years, in between 67 and 70. I'll get the right, this is a big long article here, but he had 3 years when he was, those 3 years, according to this guy, are better than anybody's ever had in baseball. As an outfielder, even better than Ted Williams. Then he went back to being just above average for the next 6 years of his career. I don't know if he had hurt or what. Mm-hmm. He says this is the wins above replacement. He says Yastrzemski was better at his peak than baseball legends like Wagner, Tris Speaker, Stan Musial, Frank Robinson, Mike Schmidt, Jimmy Fox, all these people. And he says Yastrzemski was better in his two best years than the baseball god he replaced, Ted Williams. Primarily due to Yaz's better defense, no one out-hit Williams. But it's his three peak years were really something.
And you're talking about years where, for instance, where if you look at OPS as a measure, anything over 1,000 is just Hall of Fame player. It's rare. And in 67, he had 1,040. Then he fell to 922, which is really outstanding. And then 870, and then 1,044. But also, if you look at something that he did for a guy with pretty darn good power, and he did hit over the course of his career 452 home runs, but his on-base percentages too. He was a guy who was a really disciplined hitter, and he walked a lot. So, starting in 63, you'd see 418, 374, 395, 368, 418 again, 426, 362, 452, 381, 357, 407, 414, 371. I mean, that's a long time of being a guy who is, if you cut baseball down to the smallest unit, getting on base is important. It's really important as far as team baseball. And then you throw on top of it that he got a lot of extra base hits, drove in a lot of runs, that he was just a really, I think, a terrific hitter, and maybe underrated in that regard. And part of that is that there was the year he won the Triple Crown, which was that? Was that
67,
was
I think.
67 or 60?
Yep. I think it was 67.
Yeah, I think it was 67. 121 RBIs, which was really good, and 44 home runs. It was the year afterwards. It was 68 when he walked 119 times, which is incredible, but he only hit 301, and that led the league.
Well, it's kind of it's somewhat odd in that from age 21 to 26, he averaged 4.2 WAR. This WAR thing, everybody swears by it, Kevin, and not one person can explain it. Anytime somebody swears by something they can't explain, I always get kind of itchy about that. You have somebody about they know everything about option models, so you say what's in it, and they have no idea what you're talking about. It's kind of the same thing. But so from age 21 to 26, he averaged 4.2 WAR, which is good but far from great. Borderline All-Star, which he made All-Star team 3 out of 6 years. Then his next 3 years said he was better than anybody's ever played. And at age 31, he went back down again. He just like an above-average player. Without ever really showing, said he almost compares to Roger Maris.
Yeah. So if you the best explanation for WAR, and the calculation is really convoluted and involves a lot of factors. So it really tries to incorporate as much about offense or defense, for that matter, as you can. But I think when you're looking at like a Juan Soto, you're looking at a 9 or so WAR, and what that means is, how many wins can this guy account for above the total average player in baseball? If you just took threw in all the numbers together and you had the average, how many wins would this guy account for just by being on your team above what the average player would have gotten you? So Juan Soto, who is going to make a fortune in the free agent market soon, was a 9. Yastrzemski in 67, 12.5. Yastrzemski in 68, 10.5. Yastrzemski in 70, 9.5.
He was
big time through the middle of his career.
When you have 9 guys on the field and plus relief pitchers, and one person they think is 10 games above the average at that spot, you are pretty friggin' good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, you're like really, really good.
How many players can make a 10-game difference in the standings all by themselves?
Not very many.
Not very many at all.
Because Roger Maris, people forget, he won, actually, if I can do this from memory, if you go around the diamond, almost in every spot, there's somebody who's won the MVP 2 years in a row. But there aren't very many people that have done that. Roger Maris was one of them. I mean, he was a tremendous outfielder as well as a hitter. Remember a story with a I might ask you about.
Yeah, but what do you suppose his high watermark was as for WAR?
I'm not sure.
It was 1960, actually.
Yeah, wasn't the year he hit the home run. It was the year before.
His first of the two MVPs, and that was 7.5. And the second one, where he hit 61 home runs, was 6.9. Both pretty damn good. But before that, his high water mark was 3.3. After that, his high water mark was 3.8.
Well, when you think of how
good. Yeah, it was those two seasons in there, and like so many players later on, we really can't chalk it up to steroids.
No, matter of fact, that's what they're talking about. Yes, his years were better than people who are on steroids. But I think when you people don't have a, it's hard to, unless you played a real lot of sports and realize the people you're playing against, even though we're pretty good, we're, you know, nowhere near what a professional is. Not even close. I mean, the gene pool just to get you to that spot, let alone to be good there. I mean, the average Major League Baseball player is better pretty much than anybody we've ever played with, Kevin. And for somebody to be worth that much more above that guy is really something. I mean, when you think about it. Maybe after the break, I want to kind of tie this the sports stuff together, because you kind of were ahead of me there, which is fine, with the Soto thing. How much, when you put a guy like that, I mean, I'll go back to the Soriano thing, sort of same deal. When you say, okay, we're going to pay this guy, pick a number, $20 million for the next 8 years, it's really, you're talking about a two-step calculation. One is, how good is this guy going to be on a relative basis over the next 8 years? What's his decline, if any, is going to be? I mean, these are things you would go through. I mean, people haven't done this. I mean, if you do this for companies or for businesses, you got to look at a baseball player as a new project. Okay, where's he going to be? Just like you're talking about, Kevin, is he going to be a 6 WAR for 3 years, then drop down to 4 and then to 2, and then he's averaged his last 2 years? I mean, what do we suspect his glide path is going to be? That's on one sheet of paper. The other sheet of paper is, what's the world going to be the next 8 years? What's baseball's revenue going to be? What's, if we pay this guy $20 million and 8 years from now he's an average ball player, which, you know, whatever age he's going to be, he's an average ball player at that age, is probably pretty good, seeing his average is pretty good. Now, is the average ball player 8 years from now going to be making $20 million or $5 million? That's what happened with Soriano to a huge extent. It wasn't that he didn't play well. It's that period of time, the economy was no good, and by the time his last year, he was tremendously overpaid relatively. But if you'd have taken a real bullish view of the economy the day you signed him, you'd have said his last year he's going to be a bargain. It didn't work out that way. So after break, Kevin, let's tie these two together. I mean, if you and I were doing this calculation, do we think baseball revenue is going to be twice what it is now, you know, 40% more, 50% more? If we think the economy might turn a little bit the other way, are they going to keep charging what they're charging? I don't know. Are you still going to fill up the parks? TV going to be the same way? Is it still going to be the opiate of the people? Other sports? What about people who all of a sudden like soccer, don't like baseball? 8 years from now, is soccer going to be? I mean, these are all factors when you commit yourself to $160 million, right? You would think. But I don't know. Let's try and work our way through that just for grins when we come back. SP Futures up 10. SP Futures up 46. Big news. You know, Walmart said things weren't bad. Target, not so much. Target's down $27, 17%. That's going to leave a mark. Be right back. Stacks and Jacks. Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are.
Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howell. We have Andrew on the board. We have Kevin O'Neill with us. I'm stuttering here a little bit because I was looking to see Target straddle last night. The straddle is the market's estimation on how much the stock might move on earnings. It was a hefty number. It was $13. It's doubled that. That's insane. To double a straddle was pretty big. We actually had a very tiny spread in here for some of our clients, and we do a lot of earnings plays, and we had, you know, looks like one of them was a big winner from yesterday, and this one's not much. We leaned bearish. The stock was like 150 something. I think we did the 150, thinking we were real bearish. We're not even close. We're $22 away from our bearish call, Kevin. Jesus. Oops on that one. S&P futures again up 11. NASDAQ futures up 47. Dow futures up 106. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX up 47.2%, the FTSE down 7, call that flat. CAC round up 7, call that flat. So not much going on over there. Nikkei down 62.1%, Hang Seng up again 41. These guys got clobbered a little last week, but they're still under 20,000, 19,705. Shanghai up 21.6. They're making a pretty good comeback from that big down day the other day as well. Yesterday, Dow was down 120, S&P up 23, NASDAQ up 195 as we came back reasonable amount. We're working our way back from Friday's loss is what we've been doing, because Friday was horrible. We're still not there yet, but we're working that way. Bonds up 5 basis points, 4.43. That's a pretty big move. Bund up 4 basis points, 2.38. Japan up 1 basis point, 1.08. Oil up 45 cents, 69.84, trying to make it back to 70. So kind of creeping to the middle of the range there, not the lower end anymore. Brent up 32 cents, 73.63. Natural gas up a dime, 310, back over 310. RBOB up a penny, 205. RBOB was under $2 last week, so it's crept up about 6 cents as well. Gold, which has been on kind of a tear, up 60 cents, 26.31, so it's made back half of the money it's lost. It was down, it was 27.50, then 25.50. Now it's kind of back to mid 2600. Silver's down a quarter, 31.01. Copper up 2 cents, 4.17. Foreign exchange, the euro still at the 105.5 level. That's way below what it was a couple of weeks ago. The pound, 127. And Japan up to 155. When I say up, that means the Japanese yen is down. That's 155 yen to the dollar. It's opposite the other two. I say every day, but still you got to remind yourself of that. Crypto up 695, 93,635. No matter what, crypto is going to save us all. I hope that is not a bomb rating to go off. It hasn't gone off, and so maybe it won't. What do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports, Andrew.
All right. It is 6:35 here in Chicago, Wednesday, November 20th. A little bit of sports. The Blackhawks lost to the Ducks 3-2. Chicago weather isn't looking very much better today. It is currently 46 degrees. We're going to have a bit of a cloudy day, rainy day, and a windy day all throughout. Going to be a mix of it all. And tonight, we have our chance of our first snow of the season. This is going to be even colder. And today we're going to have a high of 49. Over in Phoenix, things are not too much different. They're currently at 47 degrees. And they're going to have a bright and sunny day, but that's still going to be a high of just 47. So it won't be changing much over there. Excuse me, that's 77. That makes a little bit more sense.
47, yeah, high of 77. I'd say, wow, those people would be up. They'd be moving out of there at 47.
Like, wow, that surprised me. But finally, for Chicago traffic, thankfully no major accidents to report. We just do have some police activity. This is right off the Kennedy. It's Wilson Avenue between I-94 and Knox Avenue. The police investigation has been going on for at least a whole hour now, and things are still shut down. So that is all I got.
We're going to collect the bullets. No arrests have been made.
Exactly.
So, Kevin, what this move in Target's interesting, huh? Profits are down, traffic's down, everything's down. Where do you think we are here? I mean, we all read that article. We're jousting back and forth on it, where the one gentleman said the market's turning over and we're actually been losing wages versus inflation 2% a year for a while, which basically...
I believe he said turd of an economy.
Yeah, I mean, basically everybody, out of all the stuff we don't agree on the show, I think everybody agrees that the people in the middle have been sinking, not just staying steady, whether everybody's did better. I mean, I think we've been sinking, but...
Well, I don't think we get a lot of disagreement about the general state of the economy, too. So it is distribution of wealth as an issue. It is things like, you know, we're seeing hours being cut, working hours being cut. If we were looking for diversity of thought, we'd have to find somebody who says, oh, those employment numbers every month are just spot on. Those are so accurate.
Yeah.
We'd have to get all of that kind of stuff together. And, that's probably the least diversity we have of opinion on this show as we go from each Monday to Friday.
Well, Kevin, what's the end game? I mean, we don't know. I mean, I'm asking you for your prediction. Let's just pick one industry, and everybody knows it. I think everybody listening to the show knows that I love hacking around with old cars and trucks and stuff, and I know more about that industry than somebody who trades for a living normally would. Is that a fair statement, Kevin? Because my uncles were into cars. My grandfather loved fixing cars. It was Mitch's and Audrey's uncle and cousin, the late cousin, were both had dealerships, so I learned a lot from them. But I see this, I don't know if it's government, if it's what people want, that the new cars are incredibly expensive and incredibly complicated, to the point where I look at one of these things and I'm sitting, I don't want this thing when it's 7 years old. I mean, don't give me the 7 to 10 part, because anything that breaks here is, you know, there's a million sensors on it, there's a million everything. Most auto repairers maybe don't even know how to fix them. I think the used car stuff, I'm talking 25, 30-year-old trucks. You can't find one. And if you can, they're going for almost as much as they were when they were new, if they're from the South and no rust on them. And yet every mechanic is crowded. If you don't have a guy you've been going through for 40 years like I do, I don't know how you get in the door. I mean, try and get something fixed if it's any kind of a wreck or a body shop. I mean, it's in there for a month as they try and find sensors and parts and everything. I mean, I don't know of anybody, Kevin. Actually, my nephew's wife just bought a new Honda, whatever, little SUV. She's had one for however many years, and she's got 200-some thousand miles on it. It's been really good to her, and she went and bought another one. So that I get. I mean, she's a teacher. She goes to, you know, she drives to work every day. She deserves a nice car. I'm not at all saying. But that's kind of so rare, Kevin, right now, it seems. I mean, I look at one of these new pickup trucks and say, you can't give me one of these things. I don't even want one. But it is so far away from... I mean, what is the end game here? What's it going to be like 15 years from now? I'm not talking about electric or gas or whatever. I just was reading the other day on a show about some guy in Europe had a Tesla, and how his maintenance every year was more than any gas car he ever had. And, oh, by the way, at the end of 10 years, they want 17,000 euros for a new battery, and he chucked the thing. I mean, what is...
Yeah, when the new battery becomes a total.
Yeah. I mean, what are we doing here? I mean, there's not enough old cars to go around, especially if you're going to start salting the streets. I mean, is transportation just going to get so ridiculously expensive for people, or what? Or people, I don't know, everybody's going to be on their bike, or what are they doing?
Well, that would probably be a dream for some of the environmentalists, is that we have priced driving out of the market, and so now, yes, everybody's going to have to do public transportation or ride bicycles and things like that.
Everybody except you still get to drive.
Yeah, everybody except you. As I always say, I'll take the climate crisis seriously when Bill Gates and John Kerry and those kind of people start flying commercial.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty scary. But what if, say, for instance, somebody gave us this assignment for the Cubs and said, or the Sox, and said, do you want to sign this guy for, what do you figure he's going to go for, $22 million a year for 8 years, something like that?
No, he'll go for more than that. He'll probably get $30 million.
All right, so $30 million for 8 years. Now, what is, if somebody says, Kevin, what's the world going to look like in 8 years if this guy's an average ball player? Is an average outfielder going to be making $30 million in 8 years or not? Yeah, I don't know. I'm not so sure where I'd go with that. What about you?
Yeah, well, actually, it'll probably be 10 years, and there have been several 10-year contracts signed since 2020-ish, 2019, 2020. So it's not that unusual, and some of them are more regrettable than others. I think that when you... Juan Soto is probably not the good case here because he's only 26 years old. He's 26 years old. He's played 7 years in the majors. He already has, 201 home runs at age 26. He has a career on-base percentage of .421 for those 7 years. He had one really, really down year with San Diego where his on-base percentage was only .388. So, and I say that very sarcastically. So he's terrific in the field. So if I were to invest in anybody for 10 years, I would say this guy will probably still be a pretty good ball player at age 36. And I wouldn't worry too much about it, whereas some of those others, what you're really saying is it's at 38, 39, 40.
You dodged the question, Professor. I said he's going to be an average ball player in 8 years. Right, it would be a 5 on a scale of 1 to 10. You just said he's probably going to be a 6.5 or 7 still. That just changes the question. Does a 6.5 on a scale of 1 to 10 make $30 million 8 years from now?
Does he? Will he? I don't know. Is that going?
Well, isn't that the?
Yeah, I see what you're asking. Is baseball inflation going to push you there anyway? And I don't know the answer to that. And I suspect not. You know, not for the average player, because I think once average players get that expense, they'll just discard them and they'll bring up young guys, especially if they have a similar construct with control over player salaries. Clearly for 3 years to keep them low, and then for another 3 years to keep them moderate.
Well, we've had an inflationary, let's say, boom thing going on here. What ticket prices are, let's say it's $100. In 8 years, are they going to be $120 or are going to be $220? I mean, this all has to go into this calculation, and I'm not so sure how I do that.
And I would say ticket prices would be less part of the calculation than media, TV and radio rights. I would also say that that Major League Baseball, I don't know if Major League Baseball will do anything to spread the revenues, because they do things like the luxury tax. And the Yankees and the Dodgers and the Cubs and teams
like that.
They
spread the revenue on a major.
People will complain about the revenue tax and, the luxury tax. Oh, please don't raise it. And then they raise it, and then they go back and probably close the door and start laughing at all these other teams because they can afford it and the other. And
but your ESPN, your Fox, your ESPN, your Fox, your World Series, all that stuff is split.
Yeah, that's all split evenly.
Which is a lot. It's becoming a higher.
It's a lot, but the difference in local TV rights, you see the Cubs control now their TV rights themselves with Marquee. So as long as they can strike a deal with the people who deliver the content, they do really, really well on that. Way better than most teams would do. Way better than the Kansas City Royals would do. Way better than the Pittsburgh Pirates would do.
Well, just in terms of population, I have a feeling, Kevin, that if you and I were to do a deep dive into this Marquee, I think that thing's been a bust for them. Not losing money, but nowhere near. I mean, I'm not going to watch that until their first game, for God's sake. I'm not going to run. Every night's reruns of something. Who'd they get from basketball?
What's the production cost of all that rerun stuff that they
do? But I'm saying you're not... They've attracted somebody in basketball, I think, and they have
Well, they'll do some conference basketball games, so they pick up a little bit there. Where they, you know, they'll pick up the scraps like on an ACC game or something like that. They do the Bears post game show with, you know, the local
Wanny,
and I don't know. Do they get Olin Krutz and people like that on there? You know, so. But it's sort of the, you know, it's the one to watch if you're gonna watch a Bears post game show. I usually can't stand the pain, so by then I'm ready to just not discuss the Bears at all. But they have that. But everything they do, they pick up some women's college basketball as well. And didn't they have the Chicago Sky for a while?
I'm not sure. Hey, I got to speaking of.
So, and what I'm saying is, all of the production costs for all of that stuff is so low. And then when you show a replay of something, or you show one of their Cubs feature shows that they like to show, the production cost on that is none. It's already, it's already made long ago. So their operational expense for running a sports network is trivial. You know, it's not something. It's not. Nothing akin to what ESPN has to do. And ESPN does everything they can to do to trim production costs. You know, a lot of their crap games in the middle of the week, they just, you know, they the play-by-play guy is sitting in a studio in Bristol, in Connecticut, calling the game. So, you know, even then, I know they do that for a fair number of college basketball games, too, when they're filling their oddball schedule.
Well, I guess we're dodging our predictions here, but what do we think the world's going to look like 8 to 10 years from now if we're going to sign this deal for this guy? I'm not so sure I have a stab at it. I don't see the inflation being the same as the last 5 years.
I don't think so. I do see one opportunity, and it's not there for every player. I mean, it clearly is there for Ohtani, but it's not, and I think it's going to be there for Soto. And that is, what's the revenue stream related to the player? In other words, is there international popularity? So the Dodgers know that if they're producing their own content, that they're going to sell a whole lot of Dodgers games in Japan, which has a substantial population, and they're also going to sell a certain amount of them throughout Southeast Asia, and you know, Korea, where baseball is popular, places like that. When you get the international player like that, and I do think you're going to see a certain amount of that with Soto. I just don't know how much the money is. I think he's he might be Dominican, but there's a certain popularity for Latin players that you might be able to sell throughout the Caribbean. I don't know that that's the same kind of international money you would be considering with Ohtani, but it's there. There's something there, and so we see. We saw it some way back in the 80s with Valenzuela, where, you know, his games were really, really popular in Mexico. Now, today, you'd probably, you know, sell a whole lot of baseball product to Mexico, content to Mexico, if you had the right player to go with it.
Baseball, I think, is...
Another really good, charismatic player like that.
If I had to make a prediction after the last few years, I think it'd be more of a Soriano-type stuff. I think you'd be real careful how much you pay these guys right now. Not that I give a crap about the Cubs and their money. I mean, they get enough, I'm sure, but... I wonder how much more we can push this, Kevin, because it seems like even football, I mean, the announcers, how much money they're making. I don't see, if we think the economy is going to stagnate, I don't see the Fed doing the same thing they've done the last 5 years. Stuff isn't going to be 50% higher 5 years from now, I don't think. I mean, I hope.
Yeah, I think, Tom, the other part, though, is there is a talent evaluation part of it. Where in Soriano's case, you did not, after the first year, they didn't get anything near their money's worth. That if we go back to the WAR statistic, well, his year in Washington before the Cubs signed him, he was a 6.1, and he had some really good years with the Yankees a few years before that.
Yeah.
But as soon they signed him up, the first year they got 4.3 out of him, which is pretty good. Then they got 2, then they got -1.6, then they got 0.8, then they got 0.0, then they got 1.9. they never really got their money's worth. It wasn't a matter of what did I get in year 7 and 8. It was that they never got their money's worth in years 2, 3, and 4, and 5.
Yeah, we're talking sort of like two ships in the night here. That's part of it. But even the Magic Johnson situation, which I think a lot of people maybe don't remember, Magic Johnson got a contract from the Lakers, $1 million a year for 25 years, and everybody said, what the bleep, over? How could anybody make that kind of money for so long? Well, when he signed it, was it 3 years later? How many people were making over $1 million a year, and he was one of the best players in basketball, to the point where 5 years into it, the thing was an embarrassment, him making $1 million, right? Because I don't think we're going
to
see...
To give you an idea what the player worth was at the time, when Jordan's contract finally expired and he was able to negotiate annual deals with the Bulls, all of a sudden Jordan was signing $30 million contracts.
But even the Lakers, unlike Reinsdorf, said, wait a minute, this is an embarrassment after 5 years, and they tore it up and gave him a new one, right?
I don't recall that they did, but I'll take your word for it.
He was definitely not making $1 million 25 years later. Something happened in the meantime. I don't know how many years it was, but it became like a walking embarrassment because he was like the 100th paid player, and he was probably the top three, right? Anyway, but you know, I'm saying this is whenever you do stuff, whenever anybody builds a business, and that's why I love doing the Stocks and Jacks thing, Kevin, because you can talk about a sports example. It's no different than somebody here saying, wow, it looks like China and these chips and all this stuff is... Well, the one thing that's changed in the last 20 years economically is not that it never happened, because the military people, Lockheed and them, always had their nose up to behind the government, but now it seems like any sort of big investment, the markets are almost like your last spot. You're going to go to a state, you're going to try and get financing through them, through some kind of thing, or you're going to, you know, stick your nose up the ass of Washington and get some money. The idea of somebody just saying, I'm going to be in the chip business, or sign an outfielder or a pitcher, it's all on me. How much am I going to borrow for this? What's the future look like? I'm going to do it. That's going away at a dodo bird, except for... That's why I love talking to Dan and some of the people on the show who talk about small businesses, Kevin, because it's in you for that regard. The small business and the people you teach, the world's still like that for them, but they're never going to break into the top because you got to have government behind you to get in these bigger places, or else how do you compete with one of these people when they're paying 3% and you're going to pay 10%? Or, you know, or what do you, can you imagine going?
Oh, yeah, and just to embellish that a little bit, yeah, I live in a world where I'm getting people solidly entrenched in middle class, you know, yeah, jobs and middle class wealth.
Which is totally different than where all the money
and
is.
And then if they want to come back and they want to start pursuing, you know, higher level degrees and doing some things that might really launch a career, okay, that's a different conversation. But it's not the conversation we're having on the way in the door compared to someone who maybe goes to Indiana or Purdue or someplace like that. So, you know, it's a little bit different mindset. And I don't mean it to sound defeatist, like we aren't going to create very, very successful alumni. We will, but some of them just really are looking for the chops to have a good, solid, you know, day in, day out life.
And you're you know, as we used to say, your balls are in the wind. I mean, if you have a metalworking place, and I'm surely not going to accuse Trump of this or whoever else is going to be in after him, you know, somebody could make nice with the Chinese someday and say, these guys are our best buddies. And all of a sudden, we're buying everything from over there again, and you just put a lot of money in some manufacturing facility our people are smart enough, Kevin, to where I think they are doing a lot of the controls and not necessarily the machines. I mean, our people are not dumb. I mean, anybody who's an entrepreneur is usually pretty smart.
No, poorly educated, yeah, in many cases, but not dumb.
Yeah, and, well, God, don't ask anybody to multiply and divide if they're 20 years old. Good luck with that. But, yeah, I mean, even my... you know, my nephew's place, and I keep talking about that because the decisions are there. They're very busy. They bought some little place just to pick up the four or five people. I think they closed the place down. It was way up in Northwest Side. But they moved those customers to theirs. They did the people. And they're at the point where, unfortunately, the guy who owns the place is not doing so hot health-wise. But if he was, he'd be sitting there going, okay, is this good enough to where we can put out the five-year plan and actually buy the building across the street and increase our stuff by, you know, 20-25% when every machine is $500,000, Kevin, at least. And, you know, that machine has to run for 10 years and to get your money back. Hopefully you can get your money back quicker than 10 years. But I'm not so sure if he called us up and said, you guys are supposed to know all this crap. I'm not so sure what I'd tell him. I don't have a crystal ball. I mean, I never saw us buying nothing from overseas, buying everything from overseas. Now we want it back. We're not sure. I mean, these are decisions and political. And I don't know. I don't trust the people making them. They don't have to worry about what's coming in their pocket. I'm not talking about right or left. I'm talking about just in general. And I have no idea how to give advice to these people. Do you?
I don't. I'm making my phone go away here.
But I mean, we're not talking about can you help them with the numbers? Yeah, I can still do that. I mean, I can still do that better than most people, even though I haven't done it for 30 years. Could I help them with the numbers and go through and the break evens and the sensitivity analysis and those kinds of things? Yeah, I think I could still do that. He'd be horrified. It'd be on a 14-column sheet of paper, but that's okay. That's the way with a calculator in my hand. He'd say, what is the matter with you? But that's the way I used to do stuff. I could help him out with that, but I couldn't predict 5 years from now if he gets a total turnoff on tariffs or all of a sudden the tariffs come in and they help him out so much he should have bought it. The place should be three times bigger. How do you even know that stuff? Those are the kinds of things I think are very difficult for people in the middle class where their jobs really are in a lot of ways. I don't know how you make these calls. I mean, I really don't.
No, I don't know how you do either. It's funny you should mention tariffs because I just heard a report this morning that you have a whole lot of businesses right now that are going back to their Chinese suppliers and asking how much quantity they can get now.
Yeah, oh yeah.
They want to stockpile, thinking they're not going to be able to get they're either not going to get the prices that they want or the availability that they want after Trump takes office.
Well, you know what's surprising, Kevin, and you know, just not to be in a you know, political thing. We got a minute or two, but you know, Russell's probably on. But the when you talk to people, and I'm not, you know, the internet obviously allows you to pick things up at the tip of your fingers that you never could before without having to haul your ass down to the library, basically, right? Or, you know, go to the newspaper archives or something. But it's kind of stunning to me when I talk to somebody, you know, maybe in a library or a coffee shop or a bar, and they'll say, oh, yeah, we're gonna get rid of half the income tax because we're going to do tariffs. And, you know, after listening to this for 20 minutes, I can't shut up. I'll say something like, by the way, do you know how much the government rakes in income tax? Well, no. You know how much they rake in tariffs? Well, no. You know, 30 years ago, Kevin, I can understand that if you're going to be opining something, if you got your pie hole open. Now it takes 30 seconds to take up debt clock and go, we got $3 trillion or something in income tax, and we got like $600 billion or $60 billion in tariffs. We're not even close. Or for somebody to say, you know, we're not producing any oil. Wait a minute. All you have to do is put in here, just type in, for God's sake, U.S. oil production, and it pops up, and wow, yeah, we are. I mean, how is it that it's so easy to get, and yet people don't seem to... I mean, I can understand that going down. You know, some towns didn't even have a library, probably, where you could go in there and find this stuff. It's so easy to do this. Why do people continue to have this, even a basic lack of knowledge on just about anything they're talking about?
Well, the internet is a wonderful thing, and there is an incredible amount of good stuff. The problem is that, just to make up numbers, but to make the point, 99% of what's out there is crap, and it's opinions, it's bloviating, it's information that's just dead wrong. All of those are factors. And it's just so big that the 1% of the remaining 1% is still a whole lot of good information that's very accessible. So you know you have that going. That's good. But you have to be really good at sifting through all the crap to get to it.
Well, that's true. But I mean,
or you listen to Stocks and Jocks and you get really, really good advice about where to look for things.
Well, but we also, I mean, look where we are compared to where News Nation, Fox News, CNBC. As Dr. J once said, nobody wants to pay for information. They only pay for affirmation. That's scary.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of interesting, though, we are seeing a shift in that now. The media, the pundit world, has just, and you're seeing it in ratings. Especially, probably the worst is MSNBC, but since the election, their ratings just took a nosedive. It's like everybody who was a regular watcher there said, oh my God, these people were just completely full of crap. Everything that they thought was going to happen was wrong. They have no credibility. And you are seeing a younger group that is much, much more interested in, you know, kind of that podcast style sit down long form interview that was really successful for Trump and his campaign, because now, you know, if someone sits down and talks with a good interviewer for an hour, 2 hours, you know, whatever, then you're going to start learning a lot more, because, and like I said, a good interview, someone who's going to ask a lot of follow-up questions, that kind of an interviewer, you're actually going to learn something. And I think we are starting to make that shift, and it's being driven actually by a younger generation that is much more interested in, and maybe has more patience than we ever gave them credit for. Getting out there and seeing, you know, what kinds of options they have.
You know what, Kevin? I'm going to get Russell's opinion on this, if he's in the room somewhere.
I'm here.
This is to our, you know, I don't know if it's a positive or a negative. I honestly don't know, because when we graduated back in our day, we were going to make sure we were coming out of the '60s. You know, that group had a hold, there was a little bit before my time, had a big influence on people. When we graduated college, I mean, I didn't just go get a job. Every place I went, I was going to be a reason why the place did better, and we hired more people, and it was going to be ongoing forever. I mean, that's why when I went to Pullman, I just didn't want to make my dough and go play basketball. And I wanted Pullman to get contract after contract and have the place still be here. I mean, that was my motivation, and because the world was our oyster. I mean, we didn't owe people a bunch of money. We didn't. And when I went to the CBOE, I just didn't want to make some money there. I wanted the place to exist for the next 100 years the way it was, so people could, on the south side or whatever, could go down there and become, see how good you were on the trading floor, you know, have an industry there. I wanted all that. It wasn't just me making a few bucks. The young people I see right now, not that none of them have any vision, they don't see themselves, in my opinion, I'm asking two professors here, with a student loan around their necks, any kind of a rent is way more than they can afford. I don't see them, they're just making ends meet. They don't have the same. Now, my vision ended up not working out so hot. I mean, Pullman went under, so the CBOE, basically. But I'm saying they don't have the same kind of vision at all, that they're world changers. They're trying to make do. How the hell am I ever going to get a house? How the hell am I ever going to get a car? I'm not even close to that. We never worried about that. I could always go out and buy some car and fix it. I never even worried about that. I mean, I don't. Go ahead, Russell.
I love this because I was on the Metro a couple of years ago, and there were a couple of guys, you know, heading into work, and there were a couple of guys who were much younger than myself that just started chatting and started chatting too loud for the morning. But apparently they knew each other in business school, and they just happened to run into each other, and they were working downtown. And all they talked about when they asked each other about their jobs, all they talked about was how much they got paid and how much vacation time they got. And one guy even bragged about taking a little bit of less pay, so he got 3 weeks instead of 2 weeks of vacation. And even though, you know, and they never said where they worked, what they did, or anything else, that it was just that part, that aspect of their job. And I was sitting there thinking, God, I hope neither of these guys work at SIBO.
Yeah, I mean,
I was still working. Actually, it was long enough ago that I think I was still working at SIBO. But I was just like, oh my God. I just listening to them and how little they cared about what they spent most of their time doing. That's what we spend, our job is what we spend most of our time doing. And I know, you know, it's getting to enjoy it is not in the cards for everyone. But if you're really young, you'd think you would be shooting, at least trying to shoot for that, or have some pride in where you work, et cetera.
Yeah, I think so too, Russell. You know, I'm thinking, what was the, was it Huey Lewis maybe, working for the weekend or something like that?
Yeah,
I think there is a mindset like that. But I also think that that it requires a kind of leadership that is lacking too much in the corporate world, that wants to enlist people, that, you know, that has that attitude that Tom said, is we're trying to build something lasting here. We're trying to build something good. We're trying to build something great. You know, Steve Jobs was notoriously a tyrant to work for sometimes, but everything that he did was about being great. You know, the expression he used to like to use, insanely great. Went by the mantra that the people who change the world are the ones who are crazy enough to think they can. That was a mindset that you could pick up working at Apple that you didn't get at other places. I don't think you get that kind of visionary leadership anymore, or not enough of it. Let me put it that way, not enough of it. And it starts, you can do that at the team level, you can do that at the division level, but you can do it at the CEO level. But I think that's a big problem that we face it's a societal issue, I guess, is the best way I can say it, where we really don't have that kind of leadership across the board. It's too focused on the wrong things. And those wrong things, you know, it is as Deming would have said, you know, when he was coming up with the methodology, the quality management mindset, you're managing a company for the long haul. You're not managing the company for the next quarter's earnings. And, you know, those are two different mindsets. Earnings are a reality. I get that. I know everybody's got a report. You need to be able to, you know, you need to have financial performance to raise capital and to continue to raise capital. That's all part of the equation. But at the same time, you better have a way of enlisting your people so that they think they're working for something that's just bigger than somebody who's going to try and squeeze out a good earning 10Q next quarter.
We also have, you know, you have to have somewhat of the respect. I tell you, I got, talk about a lecture. I was at Pullman, and the contract that I was a financial guy on was hopelessly late. And was going to lose money, which, you know, wasn't so hot. And the reason was the governor talked Pullman into pulling one of the cars out. They had a car delivered there in 50 years. So could you guys make one quick so you get it here before the election so I could show it to everybody? So we pulled, we pulled all kinds of strings to get the car, but it ended up being almost a handmade car. So it didn't help with the suppliers to pull the production quicker. So we ended up with one car and still didn't deliver a second one for a month. Well, it turns out that Bleep lost the primary. Anyway, so we're losing money on this thing. And I'm the guy, right? And I know pretty much not everybody in the plant. There's a million people there. I know enough people. So Bob Johnson, this old Swedish guy, cantankerous old dude, they hired McKenzie, one of these consulting firms, to bring in four idiots to come in and tell everybody what everybody's doing wrong, right? And I had gone through all these studies and all this stuff, and so Bob says to me one day, he goes, how come you're kind of down on the dumps? I said, well, Bob, they got three of these guys coming in. All they're going to do is tell people everything what they're doing wrong and blah, blah, blah. And he goes, you don't get it, do you? And I go, what do you mean? He goes, You're our guy. You're our guy who went to the University of Chicago. You're the equal of any of these people. You better wake up. We're counting on you to take our message to the room. Because all these people, they don't just give you a parking place because they like your car. They did it because they respect you. You better act like it. I'm sitting there going, whoa. He goes, none of those guys belongs in the handball court with you or the softball field, and they're not as smart as you. So what if there's three of them? Get in there. You carry the ball for us. We're counting on you to do it. You know what? He could have slapped me upside the head, Kevin. And Russell, I did. I mean, sometimes people count on you, and you have to act accordingly. And, I'm sitting here going...
Yes. Sometimes you aspire to leadership, and sometimes leadership aspires to you.
Yeah, you're our guy. Figure it out. Duh. I mean, we know, I don't know the story of George Marshall, the day that essentially, I won't say ended, but sort of ended World War One, was he was a lieutenant. And everybody knew he had all this talent in logistics, which obviously he proved as he got older. And the Americans had just showed up on the Western Front, essentially. Well, they did a bunch of... They showed up really green, so they took a few months of training over there. But the first day they were going to show up on the line, the French were dumb enough. We'll just put your guys in there and have them run toward the machine guns. And our guys are like, no, we're too smart for that. So what they did was... There's this two-lane dirt road behind the trenches, essentially. And they said to Marshall, can you figure out a way, because there's nothing but carts and cattle on the thing, where we can show our division in the middle of the line in the morning and then move the entire division 10 or 15 miles down the road and outflank the thing with the same people. So he was able to do that. They dumped it in his lap. You've proven it. If anybody can do it, you can do it. The guy was only a lieutenant. And they ended up, that was the biggest single victory day, like, for the Allies, because the Germans thought the Americans were in the middle of the line, which they were in the morning. By late afternoon, they attacked them on another side. So that it wasn't that long after that that they had the armistice. I won't say a surrender, because there never was a surrender. And the other part was somebody said to him, George, aren't you happy? This is our finest day. And he goes, how can I be happy? Nine of my best friends are dead. What's the matter with you? One of the most chilling lines I've ever heard a guy speak. How can I be happy? Some of my best friends are dead. What's the matter with you? I mean, when you talk about war, right? Yeah, we had a huge.
Well, and let's go back to what I said about leadership. I mean, those are the words of a true leader who has that touch for the people involved. When everybody is trying to pat him on the back, he was not willing to pat himself on the back because of his connection to the people in his charge. And see, this is, when I say we're lacking this, we are. I can't tell you over the years how many times I have sat with a CEO and said, get your butt out into the warehouse and talk to people. Get the hell out to the bullpen or the operations center for a bank and talk to people. Make a connection, because they need that connection to the top. That is, if you really want them to work their asses off for you.
Why? So what? Where?
So it was always, I always made it a point. I still do. There isn't a day when I'm in the office, there isn't a day that I just don't go for a walk to say hello to people, just to touch base with people. Whether it's the advisors, whether it's the administrative people, somebody that works in the registrar's office or all that, it because it's just part of the drill. It's part of connecting with other people.
Russell, when you guys, there used to be, University of Chicago had a couple of courses like that. Do you have a course in your MBA program where, everybody's learning all the marketing and learning all the other stuff, and it's the stuff that you're teaching, where all of a sudden it's a course that does like what Kevin's talking about, where what are we going to do to be leaders? How are we going to judge how we're doing? How do we make people come with us? Is there any, you have one of those? Or most MBA programs do have a couple.
Yeah, they do, and I'm so far removed from that, I probably should take one.
I was going to say, you could teach one.
No, I could not teach them. That's not.
But you can.
I'm not a people. You would never want me managing a department or something like that. I have a group
of messages that find their way into every class I teach. I don't care what the subject matter is, and you know that's just because I feel so strongly about people accept being excellent leaders, and you can be really reserved and be a great leader. You can be that person who has the big personality that fills the room and be a leader, and you can have that, but I do not believe in natural born leaders. I don't think there is any such thing. It is a set of skills that you learn, you acquire, and you can use them in a formal role like you're the boss, or you can use them in an informal role like you're just a leader amongst the team.
Russell, I'm not blowing smoke up your behind, but anybody who has two daughters like you has been doing some leading, buddy.
Oh, no. The leader is sitting across the kitchen table from me right now.
Ah. It takes a team.
Yeah, it takes a team. I try to lead by example.
Well, maybe the little dog helped.
Little dogs help.
Yeah.
Little dogs right now.
Well, that's responsibility. Can you take care of the dog? Yeah. Can you do something? I mean, it's all along the way, learning responsibility, and it's not just all about you.
Well, I'll tell you real quickly my Demetrius Jackson story, and then I'll sign off and leave it to you guys. So a few years ago, I think it was 2015, 2016, whatever, Notre Dame had a very good team. We're within seconds playing Kentucky of getting to the Final Four, and they had one of the best leaders that I've seen in college athletics, and I was around it a long time, and I was covering it for a side hustle, so I was pretty tapped into it, and that was Pat Connaughton, who I believe still plays for the Bucks.
Oh yeah, he's still there.
And then they also had Jaren Grant on that team, who was pretty good after getting kicked out of school on a academic issue, came back, worked his way back, and really wanted it the second time around, wanted to be great. But those two moved on. And so the next year, you had sort of the designated leader was a basketball player named Demetrius Jackson. Now, Demetrius was a really, really smart guy, but he was not that natural-born leader that you'd like to see. Demetrius was... he was interesting when I was doing interviews, because I would ask him a question and he was always the guy who gave me the really, really long pause, thought about what he was going to say, and he would give you an answer that was kind of deep, when you're talking about team development or something like that. So he was always a really interesting guy. Well, his next year, when he became sort of, you're it, the other guys are gone, you're the designated leader, about 8 to 10 games into the season, I asked Demetrius after a game, I said, what have you learned about being a leader that you didn't know when you guys got together for the first practice? This was the one time that he did not hesitate. He just immediately said, it's really hard, man. He said, these are true things. You have to be on all the time. You never get to let down. You're the leader, and you have to be on, and then you have to know every single person, and who do you put your arm around to get them to perform, and who do you boot in the ass, and he just went on with this for immediately. Now I watched him over the course of the season, because he was doing this on purpose. He was trying to be a leader on purpose, which is what you have to do, and he was trying to say on purpose all the time. That's my principle that I teach. That's not the way he worded it, but that's what he was doing. And I watched him become a really good leader for a team that started really slow and wound up advancing to the regional finals and doing very well. I watched this unfold. He was a reserve guy who became a good leader, so that's doable, but it is a skill that you learn and acquire. It just takes some mentoring, and it takes some and takes commitment.
Hey, before you go, I gotta.
And I think that's the kind of thing that people are looking in the business world at some of the leadership, and they say, well, that guy's a natural born leader, he should be in charge, or that woman is a natural born leader, she should be in charge. There's a difference between a leader and a ringleader.
I got a quick question before you dash. What was the song when it wasn't a song, it was the litany where dogs will be laying down with cats and where the whole world goes upside down. I forget what that was, from the 60s or 70s. What about Indiana ranked fifth in football? Talk about the world upside down. What the hell?
Yeah, talk about it. We'll find out this weekend.
It's the pregame pep talks that I give the football team every week.
The other question I have more of a...
Because I'm the leader.
This is kind of regarding NIL, but one of our, you know, our buddy Jim, we watched the Notre Dame game in some little bar in Blue Island that I'd never been into, and of course the lady there tried to have you adopt a pit bull. Lucky you weren't there, Russell. sweet dog, God, she looked just like a pit bull. I mean, nobody wanted to come near her, but she was gentle as hell. The Blue Island police, Blue Island's not the world's best place in terms of economics, so the police actually have you can drop off, or they'll grab stray dogs, they actually keep them at the police place. And a lot of women in the neighborhood come over and walk all the dogs. I mean, a lot of people do a lot of nice stuff that they don't get any credit for. But anyway, you know Jim, JD, he's sitting there, he's been a Notre Dame fan, Subway alumni, I think he always wanted to go there or something, I don't know. But anyway, there's never been a bigger fan, even for people who went there. And he says to me, you know, since all this stuff started, where everybody's different every year, different, and all these guys are all from somewhere else, he goes, it's just not the same to me. I'm still going to watch him, he goes, but I don't care anywhere near it. How much of this do you think is affecting the fandom? You think people are all in on this?
I know it is. We see all these great games each week on CBS and ABC with packed stadiums. Even Indiana Stadium's packed right now. NCAA football attendance has been trending lower for 20 years. Now, you guys wouldn't know it because Notre Dame sells out every week.
But not really.
I went to a group of five school for my undergrad, and a really good crowd is 20,000 people. You know, and it continues to trend lower. So yeah. The sport,
I think basketball is where you would have seen it.
It's gone to heck in basketball for Memphis as well. They got to compete with an NBA team now, which does not help.
And then
the fact that they just, you know, suck every year these years, that doesn't help as well. But the NCAA football thing, what he said about not recognizing the player from year to year, that stuff's catching up with them. It's going to. It's just absolutely, and I don't know what's probably going to happen is we're going to end up with 40 schools that have, you know, really good football teams, and then other ones that have club teams, basically. And that's the direction we're going.
I agree with that, Russell. And I do think, you know, the basketball side of the equation started happening with the one and done players.
Uh-huh. Well, and it's now, gotten worse. And
now it's one and done, and you throw in that everybody transfers every year. So
you can transfer mid season.
And you can transfer multiple times. You got how many people are on their third school?
Wait a minute.
Even their fourth.
Kevin, well, we don't have that much time to break, but explain on that, Russell. I mean, here's the deal,
and I knew this last year. It just didn't register with me. There's a kid who was supposed to get some good NIL money, practiced all summer, went through all the workouts with Memphis. Played in, I think, both of their exhibition games, stormed into Anthony Hardaway's office and said, I'm not getting the NIL money I was promised, and I want it all up front and everything. He said, see you later. Well, because he hadn't suited up for a regular game, he'll play for Kansas State in the second semester.
Okay, yeah, that's what I wasn't sure. I was pretty sure you could.
Yeah, that you can that do that as long as you hadn't suited up.
Once you played a real game for your school, then you're not going to be eligible.
You're
not going to be eligible in the same season.
What do you mean by exhibition?
Because he had only played in the exhibition. He was okay.
Right, wait a minute. What do you mean by an exhibition game?
College basketball teams play exhibition games every year.
But I mean, they're on the schedule, right?
Well, if you go on their website, it'll show on the schedule, but it'll specifically say exhibition. And normally what they do is they will play a Division II or Division III team for that. So as an example, Notre Dame played an exhibition game against Stonehill this year. Well, Stonehill just happens to be run by the same order of priests that run Notre Dame. So that's the connection there.
But it was in your season ticket package, right?
It was in my season ticket package, but it, you know, it's not a game that counts. If you were to go look at their look at their record, it's not included in the record.
Oh, okay, I didn't know they had those. I thought they included them all, but okay.
Yeah, they used to play games against clubs that were traveling. They just had this group of clubs that was run by the same kinds of coaches who ran AAU programs in the summer, but that wound up looking more like a chance to give that coach a payday for his program in exchange for sending a player to my college. So the NCAA got jumped on that one and said no, that's too shady.
But now you can give the guy money and make him go to the college. That's okay.
Well, that's different.
That's the new rule now, man.
Well, Kevin, thank you much for hanging. We'll talk to you on Friday, and who knows, maybe we'll have some good stuff. Oh, by the way, I keep telling you to go, and then I keep dragging you back. What is wrong,
Colombo?
Yeah, what is wrong when if you're going to kick a field goal? Now, first of all, these coaches, even though you see it every week, and it's astounding to me, these 50-plus yard field goals. Since when did a 48-yarder become a chip shot? But I don't understand why, if you have the third down and you have the time, why don't you try and kick it on third down, where if you muff the snap or something, you get to try it again?
Okay.
Well, why do we let it tick down? So if the center rolls it back to the guy, I mean, if you did it on third down, he could just fall on it and you could do it again on fourth, right?
Yeah, because you let it tick down because you don't want the other team to get the ball back.
But if there's 8 seconds, what's the difference?
Did you not watch the Bears against Washington?
I'm saying at some point, especially with their particular... their brand of incompetence. I almost would like the down. I'm just saying. But anyway.
Yeah. All right.
All right, bud.
Hey, guys.
So Russell, we got to go break here in a second, but let's just set some stuff up. First of all, how are you? Your daughter was terrific last week.
Yeah. Thank you for taking care of that one for me.
Now I don't understand how come when she sent us the picture with Lester Holt, why isn't she showing him a picture of her with you and me?
We'll get one, because I think I'm going to bring her down there next Wednesday.
Cool. Well, she's bad. Does she get the whole week off, or what is her break like?
Yeah, she's coming home Friday.
Well, that'll be cool.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah, she hasn't been home in like 7 or 8 months, so my wife's really looking forward to it. She met Lester Holt. We'll do this real quick. She met Lester Holt at a she got a fellowship to attend a Women in Media event in New York. And it was an event where they were. She actually has a picture with Andrea Mitchell as well.
Really?
But Greenspan wasn't there, before you ask. And it was just a thing where they offered a handful of college. You could apply as a college student to get to attend this thing and network it. And she was one of 6 students that got picked to go. She took the train up from D.C., went to the event, wandered around New York, took the train home. She's like a grown up, man.
Well, that's okay.
But she. Let's just say it's a good thing that we decided not to have her on this morning, because she basically would talk 45 minutes straight about everything that happened to her. It was like she met people from NBC. Somebody told her that, you know, it said we ought to get you a job as being one of the pages at NBC, so you learn all about everything in the network. I mean, it was just a big day for her yesterday.
Now, you showed me
And Lester Holt's kind of her hero. Because he's a Chicago guy that became a national.
He's a good guy. I like him. He's a good guy.
That's what everybody says. You never hear a bad thing about him.
No, never did. Never did.
Yeah.
Hey, her press pass to Congress. She has that, right?
She's got a She has some sort of gallery pass. Yeah.
Okay, so she can't just wander in there any time and go talk to people or something, start interviewing people.
She doesn't have the same press pass her dad has for SIBO, where I can walk onto SIBO and go talk to people whenever I want to.
Oh, okay.
So no, it's not like that.
Okay.
Not at all. And in fact, she's kind of funny. She wants to stay linked with all those people because she doesn't want to get pigeonholed with one side or the other side. She's trying her damnedest to stay as neutral as possible.
Yeah, good luck with that.
I know. Well, she's trying. She's really trying.
So am I. How am I doing?
Yeah. Well, you share your opinion. You know?
Well, but my opinions are If somebody drops a problem in front of me, I try and form my own opinion instead of saying, what do the right think about it or what do the left? And I really wish more people would do that.
There's right, left, and there's logic. Let's go with logic.
Well,
You know what? That's what we're naming the party that we're starting. Logic.
We need a third party, bud. How much money do you think it would take? How many billion dollars would it have to start a third party?
You know, it's funny. Elon Musk's got $360 billion now, and I'd be able to do it. The amount of... part of the problem with starting a third party that's viable, basically have to start at least 51 different satellite offices. A national one and one for each state.
Well, I wonder if you could start... Let's talk about this after the break, but... If you could start, if you're not happy with this last election, and I'm appalled by the choices, but how it came down, where it seeming like the people on the extreme ends were the ones that were deciding things, but you know, whatever. I wonder if you could start by trying to put 5 to 10 people of the new party into the House 2 years from now, and maybe one or two senators. If you could do that.
What I would do, and I even talked to somebody that's pretty intertwined with the Libertarian Party in Indiana. In fact, I saw the guy last week when I was doing my roadshow, and we talked about a bunch of stuff. And in fact, this guy's one of his parents basically worked for Rudy Giuliani the whole time Giuliani was in New York. So this guy, he knows a lot of stuff. It was kind of interesting to talk to him, but he's more of a Libertarian. And we both agree what the Libertarian Party should do, and again, I'm just going to say it, and I'm not going to do it or be involved in it or pay for it or anything else, but they should pick their presidential candidate for 4 years from now and have that person out there in the press all the time.
But you know, you're not going to shake people up unless you win 5 House races, and then all of a sudden it's...
You have that, so now you have your national leader. And you can, and then you have somebody that you is a somebody running for a local office that you could associate yourself with.
What are you, LBJ? But, if nominated, I will not run. If elected, I will not serve.
Ha ha ha.
That's SP Futures up 9. That's SP Futures up. Let's do a quick break. We'll be right back, Russell. What do you think about these Target 9 earnings? For God's sake, we had a little spread in there, and the thing's down.
I got it. Let's not get off track because I really want to talk about that after the break.
Yeah, I mean it's a double straddle. What the hell? We'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI ProDirect can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI ProDirect. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right
now. Hello and welcome to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Allen, here to run the board. SP Futures up 9, NASDAQ Futures up 38. Hey, Russell, what I'm doing is take a look at these UK inflation numbers. They came in really hot. I wonder if we're going to be following there or not, but I want your opinion on that. Over in Europe, we've got individual stocks. Like I said, Target's down. It's only down 25 now. It was down 27. I guess that's a bounce. Nadal got Microsoft up 2. Salesforce up 3. United Health up 8. So the Dow is up 144 because of those. And remember, when somebody's up 8, that's like almost 50 points in the Dow. So it's like almost a 7 multiple. It's like 6.5 or something, or 6.6, I believe. DAX up 86.4%. These guys are higher than they were an hour ago. FTSE up 17.2%, CAC around up 32.5%. So they were like flat a while ago, and they're not. Now they're all up over there. Asia, that hasn't changed an hour because they're closed. Nikkei down 62.1%, Hang Seng up 41.2%, Shanghai up 21.7%. That's the only one that's kind of a percentage move here. Yesterday, we had the Dow down 120, S&P up 23, NASDAQ up 195. Because we're still trying to come back from the Friday debacle. We came back maybe a third of the way, maybe 40% now if you add today's onto it so far. This is troubling, though. Bonds up almost 6 basis points, 4.43 in the 10-year. That's creeping. The Bund up 4 basis points, 2.37. Japan up 1 to 1.07. Oil creeping back into the midpoint of the range, almost at 70. 69.85 up 46 cents. Brent up 40 cents, 73.71. Natural gas up 11, 3.11. RBOB up a penny, 2.05. Gold, which had been really getting hammered, but now has made quite the comeback. We rolled our stuff down, so we've been pretty long in this last 100 bucks up, so it's been a pretty good couple days for our good guys that are long gold with us. Gold up 12 bucks, 26.43. Silver up 3 cents, 31.30. Copper up 3 cents, 4.17. This is also going to be a question for Russell. The pound is at 105.5. That's a 4.5% to 5% move than 3 weeks ago. And only Russell can probably tell us how much that means to people who do foreign exchange. British pound, 127. They've come down as well, but not as much as the euro was. Crypto keeps rolling up another 1,500 points. 94,432. Boy, if that ever crashes, I don't know what that's going to do because it's going to be a lot of wealth in there. Andrew, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
All right, it is 7:37 here in Chicago, Wednesday, November 20th. A little bit of sports. The Blackhawks lost to the Ducks 3-2. Chicago weather isn't looking much better. It is currently 40 degrees. We're going to have a little bit of clouds, rain, and breezes throughout the whole day as we're only going to have a high of 49 and a possible chance of showers and snow overnight. Over in Phoenix, they're currently at 50 degrees. They're going to have a high of 77. Their skies are going to look a lot better. Not as much warmer, but going to be a lot more clear with a lot of sunshine. Finally, for Chicago traffic, there's only one accident to report. This is on the left shoulder of the Stevenson going north at Central Avenue. The report says, with no capitals or punctuation, car hit the wall.
So we can confirm, the wall won, I think.
Yeah, the car has hit the wall. So that is all I got.
There
back
you go.
To you, Chief.
And if you heard earlier, Russell, or if you ever watched him play, our rest in peace for Bob Love. And you know why I had an amazing affinity for him? He had a back issue. He really couldn't jump. Neither could I. So he was my guy in the NBA, and it was pretty damn good.
You got a 3-inch vertical?
I'm not so sure. If you could slip some toilet paper under there when I was in the air, you'd be doing good. I had none.
So hey, on the target thing, so yeah. I'm gonna deviate, but I'm talking about Target, I swear. So you know, last week you were kind enough to let my daughter come on with you, and because I was doing the road show for the Kelly School, the Future Cast, and I'm the markets person, and I basically was less than bullish going into next year. I talked about the market being kind of interest rate driven, and if we get some inflationary pressures, it's going to be difficult for the Fed to be as aggressive as everybody wants them to be. And part of the future cast is I'm supposed to come up with three positives and three negatives for the stock. My job is the stock market. Somebody else does the international economy, somebody's local economy, somebody does the U.S. economy. I have everybody thinks mine's the hard one because it's the markets. But for the markets, the one thing out of our model that was an easy positive was the consumer. Consumer continues to be strong. When you see Walmart reported yesterday, they act positively to earnings, and Target basically tank on earnings, that's the bad consumer. That in my mind, if I were seeing retail stocks hoping for a good Christmas, I might rethink that thesis right now. I've been this person. I've actually been the person where I'm out of work for a little while, and I switched from going to Target to Walmart.
I was going to say, what do you
very,
think?
Very common thing.
What do you? I mean, I don't really go to either one of those places, but I'm a member of Sam's Club, and I like Sam's Club. What is the demarcation? Is there that big a difference between a Walmart customer and a Target customer, or are they?
Yeah.
Or is it the towns they're in? Is it the places they are? I mean, is it the locations of the stores? What is it?
Well, they're both in the same location.
Okay.
Rare. And you know, and I traveled around to smaller towns in Indiana the last 2 weeks, and you would find a big Target and you'd find a big Walmart pretty much in all of the same places. I think some of the smaller places may only. I actually saw a miniature Walmart before. I'd heard of them, but I'd never seen a half sized Walmart.
They have half sized Targets in the city here. They have half sized Targets.
I know the urban ones, like the urban Walmart, which I think they closed them in Chicago because of the high minimum wage. But you've got the cool Targets that they squeeze into three floors of over on State or whatever, which I think was a great idea. I remember the first day they opened a Target in Chicago. I went to it because we'd had Targets in Memphis forever, and there was nothing. Had was just gone.
Well, Target is a successor to who? Not Kmart. Who are they? They're out of Minnesota, right? I mean, but what were they originally?
They were part of Dayton Hudson.
Yeah, but there was what was the discount name before them? Or was it always a Target? I'm not sure.
The Bonds or any of those things.
No, it was. I don't know who it was, but anyway,
yes, there is a. You've seen it. And in fact, the last time that this happened, where Walmart did okay earnings wise and Target tanked, was one of the reports in 2022 when we had all the inflationary problems.
I can go back and find it, and I'll kick up my charter. What?
Well, I've got it right here on my. I actually do a blog where I do an earnings preview, and I can look at it because I have Target and Walmart. Walmart tanked. Target was down 25%. One of their reports in 2022.
Yeah.
And that's when we had an awful lot of problems. And then everything got better, and we've had kind of mixed here. But, this isn't even the biggest drop in Target in the last 3 years.
They got clobbered in August. We got clobbered in the August numbers, too. From 150 to 132 or something.
No, that was they had a positive the last time.
Well, whatever the date here I'm looking at, there's talking of the 31st of July, it went down a boatload. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the Sam's buffer Walmart a little bit, or are they such a small piece of Walmart you don't even worry about them?
I think they're somewhat of a smaller piece of Walmart. I wouldn't.
Well, all the stuff we sent you the other day, I sent you. I don't know, but you got so much other stuff you're looking at. We were kicking around the restaurant industry. You know, somebody was trying to be somewhat bullish for next year, even though this year I guess wasn't so hot. The Buffett indicator we're so much higher. For those that don't know, the Buffett indicator is the price of the Wilshire 5000, so basically every stock, right, divided into or the GDP going into the amount of the Wilshire, right, and the stocks are higher compared to the GDP than they ever have been. It's way higher than even 2007.
Oh, there are a whole bunch of. I mean, when I did the positives and negatives, valuation was the number one negative. Although you can, I'm well aware of this, valuation for like the Russell 2000 is nowhere near where it is for the S&P 500.
Well, if you take the top 20 stacks out, you're probably going to get a little more rational.
But I mean, it's to the extent where one of the common beliefs as far as factors for outperformance is small cap outperforms large cap. I think we're damn close to the Russell 2000 now trailing the S&P 500 since inception.
Okay.
You go all the way back to the 70s, and we may need to rethink this small cap versus large cap thing.
Well, when we, I'm going to say in 2000, this is about a recollection, although we had, you know, a lot of clients. I'm going to say the QQQ, which is now 504, was like 125, and it went to 25. Is that about right? 28 somewhere in there?
Yeah, yeah. It was down 80%. The NASDAQ lost 80% in the internet bubble.
Yeah, and I'm thinking the Dow was nowhere near that. Was it like 25 maybe or 20?
No.
And the S&P was nowhere. I mean, the OEX where I was trading at the time, it wasn't down 80%.
It
might have been down 15 or
20. Because it didn't have any of those stocks.
It didn't have any of those stocks. The OEX, for people who don't remember, there's the S&P 500, which is the biggest 500 stocks, not always the biggest, but pretty much the biggest. And the OEX is it's now called the S&P 100, but actually was the 100 biggest stocks that were listed on the CBOE back in the day. So it's even a smaller set of the bigger stocks. And it doesn't trade much.
Isn't OEX, Options Exchange 100?
Yeah, yeah. You know the whole
S&P decided that they wanted a little bit of money off of the index option trading and bought that and said you can use S&P 500 for index options as well.
Well,
eventually they flipped.
You were a little bit before your time, I think. The whole history to that, Russell and I just kind of come down here, and because the OEX launched in '83, I think. But the history of it was when I my first year on the trading floor. There were no futures at all. And as when you sit there and go, okay, what in the hell did you watch all day? Well, you watched the bonds were the leaders, right, because the interest rates were so high. So if bonds started coming down, it meant that the interest rates were going up, which was bad for the market. So the market would always move with the bonds. So if bonds were down a bunch and the money supply came up and the bonds tanked, you pretty much, you know, expect the market to tank. But there was no, quote, market. It's all individual stocks. And your bellwether stock, if you're going to watch one stock, was probably IBM. Even though there were a lot of other ones. But if the market was down 1% that day, generally most people thought IBM would be down 1%. I mean, you watched IBM and you watched the bonds. And all of a sudden somebody came out with something called the Kansas City Value Line, right?
It was a Value Line futures.
It was a future. All of a sudden, all these guys came off the trading floor. When you came down, was first stop up on the 29th floor when you came down here? All these guys are sitting around smoking, drinking coffee because we smoked all over the damn place in those days. And they had about five phones in the middle of the table. And something moved or they saw something. I don't even think there was a CNBC. But they'd be watching like regular news. All of a sudden, like five guys would dive for a phone and they'd call the Kansas City Value Line. Well, then the S&P said, well, we got to get a piece of this. So they came out with the S&P 500 future. I'm going to say 81-ish, 82-ish maybe. So then the SIBO felt that they totally lost, you know, they lost everything. So they said, well, what can we do? Because the S&P 500 is already at the Merck. But there were no options. Well, there were futures options, no other options. So they said, well, but make cash options. We can't use the S&P name because it's over there, and the Merck had an exclusive to it. We're going to create our own. We're going to make the Options Exchange 100, which became the OEX. And became that Pitt was the second biggest exchange in the world for what, 15 years, 20 years?
Mm-hmm.
And now nobody trades it because everybody trades the spiders instead, which is, you know, I don't know, because now once you hit an ETF, I mean, trading on the spiders like trading on a stock, although the stock is the market. So that's kind of the evolution of all that, but I remember people trying to trade the Value Line. God, what a horrible product that was. God, is that thing still around? You with us, Russell? Did we lose our man?
I bumped the microphone and muted myself. No, it's not around anymore. Kansas City, the Value Line index futures have gone the way of the dodo.
Oh, God. So what did you think of the debt number we sent out? Those are numbers that you sent out, and you kind of look at them and you go, oh, my God.
We got that question at every stop, and this is one of the reasons that I really like doing that roadshow. We got a question about the deficit at every single stop.
I'm sorry. Back up. I was talking about the personal debt number we sent. It's now 17 trillion or something.
You were talking about the Well, we got that one as well.
In fact, when I
say the consumer is positive, I actually hedged because I had to say three positives and three negatives. And I said the consumer is positive, but credit card debt and car loan delinquencies are bumping up, you know, are bumping up against near highs. And someone, and then one of the other guys had talked about how individual debt is kind of manageable, and it's not as bad in an absolute basis because we've gotten some inflation, et cetera. So don't look at that absolute number. And I kind of refuted. I hate, you know, I don't want to show up other people that are up on the stage. But I said, but, you know, the concern here is we are seeing rising delinquencies, and that's what concerns me. If we've all got high debt and everybody's paying on it, more power to us. But if we've got high debt and you're starting to see delinquencies increase and people not make payments on their car loans, because people make a lot, people will often make their car loan payment before they'll make their house payment because you need your car to get to work.
Did you ever?
For a lot of people, that's the number one one. You can live in your car if you've got to. Heck, the waitress at one of the restaurants I had breakfast in on the road show was living in her car.
Did you ever watch? I used to watch it. No, I don't watch it much anymore. Remember?
Hop out there, man.
Did you ever watch Blue Bloods?
My father loves that show. My wife loves that show. So I see it in the background.
Well, one of the early shows, when the grandkid was getting of age, they take him out to dinner, Grandpa and Tom Selleck, and you know, man to man type of thing. So so Tom Selleck says to him, "Now look it, if you could only afford one, your car payment or your rent payment, make your car payment. You can live in your car. You can't drive your apartment." I had never heard that, and I you said the same thing.
Well, yeah, no, I just always working at hedge funds, and I worked at macro funds where we would, you know, we would make bets based on the ones that I did the best work at. We would make bets on different industries, and back in the 90s, we did a hedge fund I worked for did extremely well getting long energy, and then we got short a lot of low quality financials because we were seeing delinquencies rise. And that's kind of where we're, I feel like that's where we're at again with a lot of the financials. And if anything, and I know I'm not really giving it specific advice here, but a lot of people believe that Trump's going to be good for the financials. He can be as good for the financials as government can be, but if the fundamentals aren't there for him, they're going to have some problems.
Well, did you see the one that we sent around the other day where Trump is a you know, he's inheriting a turd of an economy was the term.
Yeah, I saw that, and I, you know, unfortunately, I think he is, but I don't think a lot of, and you know, he got elected because he is, so maybe people do realize it.
I think they do too. The thing that really is weird for me is the. I mean, obviously, people listen to the show. My view is, the economy is not doing it. Individual people are not doing anywhere near as good as the government's telling you are. Okay, I mean there's no question. There's no question. The only thing weird about this election is that Trump was there for 4 years. I mean, again, we only had two choices, but it's so weird that how can he be the fixer when he's part of the problem? But his administration. No,
well, and that's it's kind of funny. I saw a little debate around this one with him, and you know, everybody's saying that Trump inherited all the great work that Obama did. You know, and that's the only reason that there were any positives around the economy. And if you chop the COVID year off, things were going particularly well before that happened.
They were or weren't? They were or were not? We didn't hear you.
They were. Things were going fairly well when and then COVID came along and kind of made things
It depends on kind of, in one man's opinion, it depends on sort of how you look. I really believe, and I sent that out to you guys last weekend, that if you go back to 2000, really, and you chart the inflation, the healthcare, the income
stuff, the house stuff, the car stuff. I think the average person has been losing versus inflation for 24 years, and maybe more. And if you, and guess what? We've had 12 years of Republicans and 12 years of Democrats. And if I didn't tell you where the presidents were, and you just looked at the lines in the charts and saw the degradation of people's income, you can't even tell when one person gets in the presidency or not. The idea that one side is causing it versus the other, whichever you happen to be on, I tell you what, I very seldom say something like this. That's insanity, because it's been whatever. Even though they come at it in different directions, they all get to the same place, right? I mean, Reagan's the Reagan's the one who started the deficit crap when he cut all the taxes. And not saying he should have or didn't, but maybe they cut too much, maybe they didn't. And then George Bush, I mean, for God's sake, the guy doubled the deficit when he was in there. And he was the only, and he's the only president that I could find going back that had lower oil production when he left than when he went in. And he's supposed to be an oil guy. I mean, the only thing about the different parties is the normal the normal mantra, for lack of a better term, is usually wrong. I mean, people will say Republicans are good for the market. Yet if you go back to whenever the Dow started, the market has done slightly better under Democrats than under Republicans. So
yeah, I saw a lot of those numbers when we were on the road show, and the only time that you really should be concerned is when one party has total control of all three, you know, of the Senate, the House, and the presidency.
Why do you say that's that?
Just the figures. That's what somebody cited with numbers. He showed the numbers.
Okay, but you're going back maybe a little further, but I seem to recall in the last however many years, that's happened a few times, right? It seemed like every time the guy was able to do nothing because his party was fighting almost as bad as the other people were.
Seems that way, doesn't it?
Yeah. What?
But that all we, you know what? You know who the best president, I think, in the 20th century was?
Roosevelt?
You know why? He basically played golf every day and showed up and signed bills every once in a while.
Who is this, Obama?
Eisenhower.
Well, I actually wrote somewhere buried in our website.
Eisenhower.
I wrote a column about him regarding his beware the military industrial complex.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? I think you're, in some ways our personality is kind of the same. You don't play golf for 8 years and then give that as a parting shot. If anybody could have stopped that from happening.
Yeah, should he have done something about it for 8 years? That's probably a pretty good point there.
I mean, who knew better about the ins and outs, whose nose is up the other person's ass, between military and government than Ike? If anybody could possibly have done something about it, it would have to have been him, right? Wouldn't you think?
Yeah.
And, you know, I wonder, yeah. You know, it's funny, we talk about now everybody's pointing fingers at everybody and everything. I've been trying my best, especially since Lou's been on, and Mike, trying to learn something so I don't sound like an idiot talking to those two guys who know a lot of this stuff. I've been doing an awful lot of research on this World War II stuff. I'll tell you what, George Marshall, pretty much, he made Ike. I mean, Ike was went to the War College, he was able to, he's the first guy.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, his... When they had that, you probably know this, they had a practice, talk of a better term, they had a practice landing somewhere. It was, I don't know if it was in Britain or someplace, to kind of practice for Normandy.
Mm-hmm.
And Ike gave the okay to use live rounds. And somehow the Germans caught wind of it, and they sank a bunch of ships in the, I don't know how many, I think they lost more people
during the practice
than they did on D-Day. If that would have happened today, or as many, I mean, I don't quote me on that, but if that would have happened today, that decision of Ike to use live rounds and then the people showed up at different times so our own stuff was landing on our own people, that guy'd have been out in a second, wouldn't he?
I think so. But did everybody know it at the moment?
He was their
guy.
You
know, I mean, when things happen now, we know it immediately.
Yeah. Well, I mean, some people know it. But his strength was he had gone to the War College, and he was one of the first generals, if not the only, other than maybe Marshall and a couple of the other guys, probably the guy who was the Air Force guy and the Navy guy, clearly the Navy guy. They realized that part of being the top general is the politics between all the different countries that were involved in the Allies. It wasn't just, you know, like Patton, who maybe was a better general, but it was, it's my way or the highway, shut up. I mean, you can't do that when there's 10 other countries involved, right?
I mean, right. I mean, and Eisenhower had to, you know, manage the French, manage the British.
Yeah.
You know, decide who gets credit for what, all that kind of crap.
I mean, he was able to somehow deal with Montgomery. Can you imagine Patton? I mean, Walmart Bradley, maybe. Can you imagine Patton dealing with Montgomery? Jesus.
Part of me wonders if Bradley was one of the smooth over guys as well.
A little bit.
I mean, he's kind of depicted that way in the movie, Patton. And I've always wondered if, you know, because only one guy can only go talk to so many people each day.
Yeah.
And he's got to dispatch people. And Bradley comes across as is kind of like the, if you've got a peacemaker at work.
Wasn't he head of the Defense Department? He got Marshall's job after the war. And he also, was he Secretary of State too or something? He had a career after the war. Pretty serious. Because Marshall went over to, you know, if we could find it, I have to, even though she could barely understand her, way back in the bowels of Stocks and Jocks, I had a lady on here who was part of the Marshall Plan.
Oh, wow. That's really cool.
She was like 90 when she came on the air. We'll see if Matt Bird can find that. And when she went over there, it was like she was like 20 or 22. And I said, God, what was it like? And she goes, everybody had the idea that they had these problems. All of a sudden, we had the Marshall Plan, and everything was okay. She goes, that's not the way it was. Every German town we drove into, there were mobs. It was chaos. There were fistfights. She goes, there was no...
Oh, flight. I can imagine.
The place had nothing. It wasn't the next day everything was okay. It took a long time, and a lot of people through the town government, the town police forces to form again. She goes, it was a big deal. It wasn't just this miraculous one.
Who could you trust? Who could you, you know, how do you vet who you're going to make the, and I assume a lot of things were just instantly appointed. So let's say you need a police force in a little town of 50,000 people. You know, how are you going to trust to put in that spy?
Well, especially as the last group was probably in the Gestapo.
You vet people Well,
I'm looking forward to next Wednesday, bud. I will see you then.
Yes.
And Andrew will be in. It'll be a fun time. S&P futures up 4. NASDAQ futures up 7. We'll even go deeper into what next year is going to look like because I don't like the way these numbers are up that, but I also think maybe we can grow into them. I hope so. I mean, Carl and a few other people think there's no way, but I'd like to give it a chance and hope it works. But somehow or another, what do we got to do? We got to have the price level where it is now, and we have to have everybody making 10% more 5 years from now. How are we going to do that?
They're going to have to grow into it.
Yeah, and let's.
When I got those, you're bringing up a lot of things that I got on that roadshow, and that was one. I'm like, we're going to grow into it.
All right, bud. Well, let's talk about it next week, if not before. Yep. Again, we're almost flat. We're only up 3. NASDAQ up 7. And again, Target, the big number, down $25. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.